It isn't fair at all on comedians that people say, oh, well, I had that Griff Rhys-Jones at my dinner party the other night and he wasn't funny at all. Well, I mean, that's really not fair. If you have a sewage worker to dinner, you don't say, well, I don't even believe he was a sewage worker. He didn't rummage in our toilet once, you know. You don't expect people to, you know, it's a job comedy like any other. And, of course, Griff can be very funny, for example, but it's true. The pressure of all kinds on comedians is immense. I mean, intolerable, I would have thought.
Goonpod. My name is Tyler Adams, and this is a podcast in which me and my guests talk about comedy, with the emphasis usually on Sellers, Milligan, Seacombe, and so on. But when I'm lucky enough to welcome to the show someone of the caliber of this week's guest, pretty much everything is up for discussion. The guest in question is a groundbreaking comedy producer and writer who was once described by the Daily Mail, that most thoughtful and nuanced representative of the Fourth Estate, as a well-known communist at Cambridge. Welcome to the show, John Lloyd.
Hi, Tyler.
Do you recognise that description?
I do, and of course it was the wrong John Lloyd. They got the wrong guy.
Oh, really? Did you know that? No, I didn't know that.
No, a double-page spread, well-known communist at Cambridge. I wasn't even a member of the Liberal Club. I was so apolitical in my early 20s. And it was, in fact, the financial journalist, John Lloyd, who edited the New Statesman, who was a communist at Cambridge, who I know slightly. But it was interesting because in those days, we just laughed about it. You know, it was a stupid mistake. I didn't sue anybody. I didn't, you know, get upset about it. It was just like, yeah, okay, hopeless journalism.
Yeah. Am I correct in thinking, was it triggered by the puppet of Prince William on Spitting Image that caused this?
There was a big furore about the royal baby, as it was then known, William, as he became, because a brilliant young journalist on I think Birmingham Mercury broke the story that we were doing a puppet of a baby. And there was a lot of hand-wringing about, you know, how can they do this to an innocent baby and all that kind of stuff, as if the baby would care two hoots.
Yeah.
It was actually brilliant publicity for Spitting Image. Jeff Baker, his name was, he went on to be the publicist for Paul McCartney and had rather an amazing career.
Oh, wow. Okay.
He spotted this was a good story and it was splashed all over the nationals. I don't know whether that was what got the Mail to run that absurd story. Because, you know, I'm BBC trained. We were trained to be balanced and so on. And it was difficult in the early 80s with the Labour Party almost invisible to try and do a story about them every week, which we did religiously.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit more about Spitting Image if we get time shortly. But obviously I wanted to get you on to talk about your career and whatnot, but obviously this is it's called Goonpod, so it takes as its heart the goons and them as a group and collectively, them as a group and as individuals. And I know that I'd looked actually, you're 4 months younger than the Goon Show, John, actually.
Am I? That's a very good fact.
Although it was known as Crazy People back then. And then it became the Goon Show a little bit later. But I know that you did indicate to me that as a young radio producer, you were once invited to give a talk to the Goon Show Preservation Society. And you
indeed
felt a bit of a fraud.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Well, I didn't know much about them either. It was the generation before me. It was people who'd been young in the war, you know, and it was the go-to funny show, as Python was for my generation.
Yeah.
But to be perfectly honest, as a kid, I didn't really get what they were on about. It's not that I didn't like it. It's just that it wasn't part of of my landscape, really. There was another thing called the Glums. What was that in?
Take it from here.
Take it from here. It's like I just had no idea. These people seem to be barking mad. I never really grasped it. And all those sort of voices, I honestly don't know what they're on about. I was much more the shows that we listened to really religiously were the Navy Lark, because my dad was in the Navy. We thought that was hilarious.
Mm-hmm.
Left hand down a bit, and then the sound of a warship crashing. The Clitheroe Kid.
Really? You liked the Clitheroe Kid? Wow.
Yeah, we liked that. We thought it was very funny. And, you know, you sit around the roast chicken Sunday lunch listening to these things, and it was a national institution. And also Round the Horn and subsequently Beyond Our Ken. Those were really the things that influenced my sense of humour. Not so much the Goons, although Peter Sellers was very influential to me because he did an album.
He did.
Do you know it?
I do, very much. Yes.
So, you know, Bellham, Gateway to the South, you know. I make the little holes in the end of toothbrushes. And I used to know all the voices from that album. That was really such a big deal for me. But again, I didn't really know that Peter Sellers was a Goon Show person. I just, for some reason, my parents had very few albums in their collection, and that was one of them. And I listened to it over and over and over again till I wore it out. Very, very funny. And still, it's still funny today, actually, I think.
The little holes in the top are put in manually, or in other words, once a year. I recently had the honour of demonstrating my craft before the owner of ice. He stopped by one day for a couple of words. I did not understand either of them.
It's peripheral to me, the Goons, in the sense that, for example, I loved Michael Bentine's It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. I mean, when that came out...
It's a square world.
It's a square world, right, yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry, we loved that, all the little, you know, puppety things and... We just thought that was brilliant. So being invited to talk to the Goon Show Preservation Society was fraudulent even then. I mean, it went very well. It was very enjoyable. But I don't know what on earth I said. I can't remember.
Well, I was interested to get you on because I want to talk about your career, obviously. But also, I mentioned that you're four months younger than the Goon Show. And its first producer, of course, was Dennis Mayne Wilson. And I know that he was a bit of a mentor to you.
He was. He took me under his wing as a very baby telly producer. I think I even met him when I was still working in radio.
Hmm.
And a wonderful, wonderful, radical, marvelous person. Not just the Goon Show, but of course, Till Death Us Do Part, a real groundbreaking producer. You probably know, Tyler, famously, that when it became called The Goon Show, I suppose, must have been the second series.
Mm, yeah.
And it went up before a thing called Programme Review Board, which was the, you know, the great and the good of the BBC sitting around opining on whether programmes are any good or not. And in those days, there were very much Hungarians on the review board because there's many emigres very interesting, very intelligent. So you'd often have this conversation with a Hungarian and a German saying, you know, this is very not British. This show is not British. And one of these things, the Goon Show was up and somebody said, now, has anyone here come across this Go On show? Because it strikes me as very unfunny indeed. They were that... It was ever thus, you know, the management is always kind of a couple of beats behind the curve somehow.
Wasn't Dennis quite a prolific smoker and drinker and all the rest of it as well?
Yeah, well, I'm, to be honest, everybody was. I mean, people did not look after their health terribly well. There was a lot of smoking and drinking. You quite often in the television gallery, you couldn't really see the screens because there was so much smoking going on. Yes. And it really, that lasted really right up till John Burt's director generalship, where he sort of, you know, decided that people should go to the gym more often and they installed a handbag shop in the foyer of broadcast of television centre. I remember. I thought, okay, these are not my people anymore. But yeah, it was madcap, you know, radio and telly back in the day. It was very free. Everything was very instinctual. Very people commissioned programs on the gut, you know, because. Mm. As a young producer, my head of department looked me in the eye and say, are you really sure you want to do this? And I go, yeah, I'm absolutely sure. Okay, fine. Off you go. Make a pilot. Please don't screw up. That was the way it worked. And, you know, but it's funny, each generation, you know, grows older. I suppose it's probably the same for me. But I remember Dennis accosting me in the BBC bar after one episode of Not the 9 o'clock News saying, you've gone too far. You've really gone too far here, John. You absolutely, this is disgraceful. From the man, of course, he was the madcap radical of his day. In fact, that go-on show conversation happened with the programme review board. Dennis allegedly went up to the roof of Broadcasting House and stood atop the building where it just above the Eric Gill statues and threatened to jump off the roof unless the Goon Show was recommissioned.
I've never heard that before. Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
No, because it was driven by, you know, you sort of think of the BBC in the old days as being a bit stiff, you know, and there were a lot of tweed suits around and all that kind of thing, but it was driven by passion. And the management understood that if somebody cared that much, they weren't going to cancel it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And people really cared about what they did. People were not very well paid, but they really believed in the project, in the, you know, the whole Reithian ethic, which was that common people, as it were, might not get this yet, but they will come round. If it's any good, they'll come round. And people had a very, very strong sense of quality, which had, you know, there's not necessarily any correlation to speak of between quality and, you know, rating success. Mm-hmm. And there's a very long tradition in the BBC of sticking with things that weren't getting the figures. Python's a very good example. It rated very poorly. It went out very late at night. It was a very cult thing to begin with, you know, a lot of students and things. Similarly, Fawlty Towers, which...
Only Fools and Horses as well. That, oh, I that limped that. Along for two series, I think, before it was repeated. And, yeah.
I mean, I really wouldn't have a career if the BBC had cancelled a wobbly series after the first go, you know, Not the 9 o'clock News, Blackadder. A lot of my friends, Spitting Image was an ITV show, of course, but a lot of my friends wouldn't talk to me after the first series. They thought it was so terrible. Because if you're going to do something that's groundbreaking, it's not easy. You know, people are late adopters. They prefer something that's familiar. And, you know, it's like Sun Tzu said about in The Art of War, you know, no plan survives contact with the enemy. That no matter how good the idea, it takes a while to get it right, you know, to tinker with it and get the edges sorted out. Yeah, but that nowadays, you know, you don't get a second series. If it doesn't rate, that's it. You know, yes. you've got one chance. Well, The Office is another very famous example, is nobody really understood what on earth that was. And it was put out very late at night and people found it. Royal Family is another very good example. Everyone thought, well, this is very niche, four people sitting on a sofa or whatever it was.
Yeah.
This is not a BBC thing. This is a culture thing, is that people want certainty in art now. You know, they want to be sure that this is going to, that Beethoven or Van Gogh is going to be world famous off the first few bars of music or the first painting. That's not the way it works. You know, if you're going to be any good, if you're going to be memorable, you're going to be booed roundly for your first opera. And, you know, the Impressionists, you know, famously were, it was an insult, the Impressionists. Like, well, what's this? It's a vague impression of proper painting. And that's the thing that it's, I suppose it's my zone, really. I'm not really comfortable doing something which is a brand leader. I like to be somebody who everyone thinks this is never going to work. This is absolutely hopeless.
I guess most of the shows you've been involved with were largely devised by you, or sometimes in collaboration with others, but you're not one for coming to a project late when it's already well established, basically.
No, I've never been a gun for hire. I've always done, tried to do new things. Virtually all the things I've done have been collaborative, usually with at least one other producer. And, you know, Spitting Image, obviously, is a huge team of people, all of whom contributed a small amount to make what it became. You know, you can't... I used to get quite, back in the day when I cared, quite cross when people would say things like, was Spitting Image your idea? And I said, well, I did have the idea for doing puppets on Not the 9 o'clock News, but really it's a group effort. And actually, Spitting Image is a terrible idea on paper, which is, we're going to have 1,000 puppets of famous people. Oh yeah, how are you going to afford that? And it's going to go out at 10 o'clock at night and get 15 million viewers. I mean, obviously, that is not a business plan that stacks up. It's a completely hopeless idea. Mm. Rather like Leonardo da Vinci saying, I think people could fly to the moon. Oh, yeah? And how you've got a thing that looks a bit like a helicopter, but have you invented the internal combustion engine and, you know, rocket fuel and, you know, the computer? It requires a lot to do something which, you know, it's like the famous Woody Allen one. I liked the early funny ones, you know, that people used to say about his films when nobody watched them. But then with hindsight, everyone thinks, oh, yeah, I was there when it was new. No, you weren't.
Yeah.
Most people aren't. Yeah. So it's interesting with the Goons, you know, that there's something so bonkers could have, you know, apart from a little bit of wobble with the management, really, you know, the nation took the Goons to its heart really very quickly. And maybe that's a war thing. You know, you've just lived under through the most terrible survival thing, and suddenly everyone's, you know, dressing up in silly costumes and larking about because, you know, they're so grateful to be alive.
Did you work with Milligan at all?
Yes, twice. And Spike, obviously, as a sort of lifetime comedy servant, of course, a genius, you know, of course, brilliant books, you know, and as having researched him since, not as a consumer as a child, but as an adult, you think, well, there are very few people who've made such a dent as Spike has. But, you know, famously, a very mercurial person could be extremely difficult, could be utterly delightful and charming, and you just never knew which Spike you were going to get. You know, the famous saying was, never work with dogs, children, or Spike Milligan. that was the business saying. And so the first time I worked with him was on a newish quotation series called Quote Unquote that ran for 40 years or something. It was very early on.
Yeah.
And I learned as a young producer that people actually really like doing radio. You don't have to dress up. There's no makeup. You know, the car parking's very easy. You just pitch up, you do your thing, and you go home, go to the pub. It's lovely. Mm. So we if you look up the casting of the first series of Quote Unquote, it's really good. I mean, there's Tom Stoppard, there's Jonathan Miller, Spike, as I say.
Oh, really? Oh.
Oh, it's fantastic. I mean, every week.
So it wasn't Nerys Hughes every week.
No. It was very good, actually, the early Quote Unquotes. We were very, very brave, and people delivered. And so Spike was on with Terry Wogan. I can't remember who the fourth person was, but I had, as a young single man, been watching telly one day, and I saw this program called, I think it was called Man Alive, must have been made by Granada. Mm. And there was a incredibly beautiful young reporter on this thing called Anna Ford, wearing a sort of white French mac and her hair blowing in the wind. And I said, I was single, and I thought, gosh, I'd really like to meet her. She looks really something else. So I phoned her office and said, I'm work for the BBC, I'm in radio. Do you fancy being on a panel for a quotations quiz? And of course, nobody'd ever asked a news reporter that question before, least of all her. And so she said, yes.
Anna Ford, your title is Eating People is Wrong.
Eating people is wrong. Eating people is wrong. It's somebody like Desmond.
Desmond O'Connor.
So she turned up at the Paris Theatre in Lower Regent Street, and of course, Terry Wogan and Spike Milligan, who was sitting either side of her, immediately fell completely in love with her. And so we're all getting on so well, the game sort of was falling to bits, and Spike said, I think we need to go and get a bottle of wine. Can't do with this BBC coffee. And during the recording, in front of 500 people, he went outside the Paris studios, got into his Mini, drove to an off-license, got a bottle of wine and came back, a bottle of wine and several glasses. And it went with a real swing, that episode. And afterwards, of course, Terry Wogan and Spike Milligan, being super famous, took Anna Ford out to dinner, and I never got to meet her.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
They didn't invite you?
No, sliding doors moment, really. But it was, anyway, I've got to know Anna since. She's just the most delightful person, and shared that story with her, obviously.
Yeah.
And so that was the first time. And then in the mid-70s, and then it was probably 20 years before I met Spike again. And it was a commercial when I directed ads in the late 80s and 90s for about 10, 12 years.
Yeah.
And didn't work in telly at all apart from that. And Spike was cast in this ad. I can't even remember what the product was. Nothing terribly interesting. And I called him up and said, you know, what sort of set would you like? And he said, well, I really don't mind. I'll just turn up and do the thing. And so I thought of what I thought was a funny idea for a set. And when he arrived on the set, he said, whose is this pathetic idea for the set? And I said, it's mine, Mr. Milligan. He goes, well, it's the unfunniest thing I've ever seen. Ah. And it was very difficult, actually. I was appalled that I'd upset him, and he's quite cross. But I don't know, somehow we got talking, you know, and we discovered that we both have Irish roots. So that was one good thing. And then that we both very keen on rugby, so we sort of bonded, and it actually went very well in the end. But he could just go off on one like that, you know, and you never knew whether he was going to literally, as he did with quote unquote, literally walk out of the door and disappear for half an hour, or whether he was going to mollify and be brilliant.
Well, he could turn on a dime, really, his moods and whatnot. I like as well the fact that. So when Not the 9 o'clock News was the first series, at least, which I know was a bit of a, it wasn't a disaster, of course, but it was seat of the pants kind of stuff, the first series, wasn't it?
It's, you know, you're finding your feet. I think that, you know, I knew Chris Langham oddly better than all of the others, really, but...
Well, he was who I was coming to, because he was a link with Milligan, of course.
Yeah, he obviously worked on the Q series with Milligan and with him, and but he, you know, Chris also, you know, he's a complicated person, and he wasn't right for the chemistry ultimately, and it was only when we elevated Griff Rhys-Jones to one of the main four that it suddenly started to gel. And you know, we were finding our feet, and I think one of the things that we were trying to find a new style that was uniquely us. And I think you'll see that in sketches like Gerald the Gorilla, or the famous sketch about Monty Python, you know, the life of Python in the first series, or Andy Hamilton's wonderful sketch about the stunt Pope. We was trying to find what our unique voice was, and Chris was slightly a kind of drag anchor, always trying to pull it back to what Spike would have done or something like that. Yeah. And it, you know, it is very difficult when you're trying to I mean, all comedy is essentially the same thing, obviously trying to make people laugh, but the flavor of it, the style of doing it, is it takes time to find that voice. And it was only really when Chris left that we suddenly found, okay, this is what we do, which is not like Monty Python. It's not like The Goon Show. It's something else. And I think that's true today. I think that when you see a good Not That I Cook News sketch, is not like anything else.
Because I know that Rowan tended to be the one that most people talked about. But I always sort of gravitate towards Mel Smith in everything, to be honest, because he brings a real naturalistic style to everything he appears in. And is it true that you offered him Not The 9 o'clock News the day he was planning on giving up showbiz and going to work for his father? Is that correct?
So I found out many years later. Yeah.
Mm.
And what he couldn't do, it's nowadays called the pilot, but there was no pilot for Not The 9 o'clock News. There was I was given a series of six without a pilot.
Mm.
Rush around trying to find people, and I asked Mel to be in it, and he couldn't do it because he's working at the Royal Court as an assistant director.
Mm-hmm.
But it definitely was, he was about to give up theatre and go back to work for his dad, who was a bookie in Chiswick, and that gave him the sort of handhold. And then the series was cancelled after the first episode because a general election was called by Jim Callaghan.
Mm.
And I was able to go back to Mel and say, we've made a pilot. It was the first episode, but fortunately it never went out. And he came around to my house and I showed him it. And he said, you know what, John? That's the unfunniest half hour of television I've literally ever seen. Because again, we really didn't know what we were doing. I'd never made any telly in my life. I was a radio guy.
Yeah.
And Mel was such, you're right, Tyler, it's perceptive. Mel was such a central person in Not The 9 o'clock News because it was his naturalistic acting style that became the sort of hallmark. You know, the Python thing is, you know, oh, hello, Mrs. Pepperpot, you know, funny voices. Mm-hmm. And people are called things like Colonel Volstrangler. And so it's very much in that air to the Goons tradition, I would say. And Not The 9 o'clock News is a different thing. It's trying to parody television much more realistically and exactly. And we used to have these two methods. We'd get, you know, scripts in, and, you know, very often they would be sort of by the book scripts. And on Not The 9 o'clock News, they were known as Knock Knock Come In Perkins sketches.
Mm.
And there was, you know, Knock Knock, yes, come in, Perkins. Hello, sir. Now, Perkins, how long have you been at this zoo? I've been at the zoo 64 years, sir. Yes, Perkins. And do you know what a hippopotamus is? No, sir. You know, that it's like it's got a sort of template.
You writes know. Itself, virtually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Mel's great contribution was to take the dialogue that was sort of like out of a sort of manual of comedy script writing, very funny and all that, and make it like he meant it.
Yes.
And so we had these two methods called roughening and plumpening. And roughening was mucking about with the dialogue so that it was the way it had pauses and ums and ahs in it, the way a person would really speak. It was a really marvelous thing that he did. And then plumpening was adding in extra jokes to the script, which we sort of kick around in rehearsal.
Mm-hmm.
So that it had that at its best, Not The 9 o'clock News, a bit like Blackadder, has that very dense style, which is the jokes just keep on coming at you.
Yeah.
It just, there's never a moment where there isn't another joke just lurking around the corner.
Two, please.
Are you over 18?
I'm 29.
You don't look 29 to me.
Well, I am.
How old's the jailbait?
My wife is also 29.
Have you got passports to prove it?
No, is this some kind of a joke?
Are you sure you wouldn't prefer to go and play hula hoop?
No, I'd like to see the film, please.
I'm afraid that's impossible until you can prove you're 18. You see, people are maturing a lot younger these days, Sonny, so you can't tell. Apparently, one in three schoolgirls has a teenage child by the age of 14.
Listen, I'm 29 and I look it. How old are you then?
92.
92?
Well, there you go. You see, appearances can be deceptive.
Look, come on, come on, come on, you long-haired layabout. Hurry up, get back to school where you belong.
Hey, what?
Look, if you can't get in, why don't you just accept it, eh? And let some adults get in and see the show.
Look, I am an adult. I've got a job and I wear suits.
Who does he think he's fooling?
It's a disgrace, isn't it? We become a nation of liars. I haven't had a true word spoken since Lord Lucan said I'm just going down the pub. They're probably on drugs.
Look, I'm not on bloody drugs.
Don't you swear in front of me, oh. Young man.
It's a disgrace, isn't it? Ever since the Queen married that Greek, it's been bloody this and bloody that.
Look, just shut up and let me in. I'm nearly 30, for Christ's sake.
I don't care how bloody old you are. You'll be 150 for all I care, and you're not coming in here.
You can't do that.
I voted for Margaret Thatcher, and I knew what I bloody well like. Now, stop.
Tremendous integrity as an actor, and Rowan caught that off Mel. Because he thought, oh, okay, this guy really knows what he's doing. I think Rowan learned a lot from Mel.
Oh, really? Okay, and that's interesting.
A lot of their partnerships, I often thought, I wonder what would have happened if, instead of it being Smith and Jones, it had been Smith and Atkinson, because
oh, blimey,
they really got the point of each other on the set. You know, they formed an amazingly creative partnership between them.
I don't know if this was directly related to Mel, but you've gone on record and said that the best comedy is where if you turn the sound down, it looks like it could be serious drama.
Well, that's the comedy I like. I can't say that it's the best, but I like it that if you do it really well, it's so well acted that you don't know it's funny until you hear what they're saying. And you could see that, for example, is definitely something... Well, Rowan always had a bit of that, the famous schoolmaster sketch. There's no hint that this guy thinks it's funny. He's being really cruel and vicious. And that, of course, is... That's the bit of Rowan's acting ability I love, is yes. The very dark stuff. I'm less keen on the Mr. Beanie things. I like him when he's... The dark side of Blackadder is very, very strong, I think. And again, that's something... Was definitely a lot of Mel Smith in there, I think.
Look, because obviously Rowan left not the 9 o'clock news, or at least he basically said at a dinner, didn't he? Sorry, chaps, been very nice working with you, but I'm going off to
to
do something else. And he went off and made what was originally going to be called one of the working titles, Prince Edmund and His Two Friends. Is that right?
That's what I understand. Yes, and I didn't do the pilot, which eventually became the Blackadder. It was produced by John Had Davis, and I think I'm right in saying. But after they'd done it, they came back and said, oh, please do the series, and I kind of relented.
Can I just say, because I've said this many times, I've said it to him blue in the face, and people don't believe it, but after Blackadder 2, the Blackadder, the first series, is my favourite.
Well, I'm so pleased you say that, Tyler, because again... like the first series of Not the 9 o'clock News, it's not without merit. And actually, the third episode in the first series, The Archbishop, actually won an Emmy.
Mm.
So it wasn't... Somebody thought we were doing something properly. But we... And again, it's partly my fault. They re-showed the pilot on UK TV recently as part of a new documentary.
Yes.
And it was perfectly obvious to me what the mistakes we made were, which was you can see, looking at the pilot now with all that distance, you can see immediately that Rowan's skiving, scheming character is the core of the thing, and the rest of the royal family are really completely irrelevant. Nobody cares about them. But we kept those elements, which made it a bit hard work. And then I had the stupid idea of giving him a silly pudding bowl haircut, which is... made him into a nerd, which is hard to relate to. But nonetheless, you can see the beginnings of classic Blackadder with that, the triangle of Baldric and, Lord Percy and Blackadder working together. There's some very, very good bits in there. And of course, some great dialogue with the, they're going through the sacred relics and the Archbishop of all the sacred relics and what Jesus made in the carpentry shop. There's a very nice cheese board here. It's just marvellously cheeky.
Look, I can tell you that out of the last probably 5 or 6 episodes of Goon Pod with previous guests, for various reasons, we've talked about the first series of Blackadder, specifically the Witch Smeller Pursuivant
episode,
and the Queen of Spain's Beard with the wonderful Miriam Margolyes and Jim Broadbent.
Yeah. It's a funny thing that this sort of, it's almost a pattern that you can't escape, which the first series has radical things in it which are really marvelous, but it's messy because people don't really know what they're doing. And then there's a golden period in the middle where people have completely got how to make it. They've found their voice, but it's still really surprising, including to the people who are making it, of course. By the time you get to the 4th or 5th series, you've sort of got what your joke is. You know, with Not the 9 o'clock News, it was stock footage of the Queen Mother on a horse, and the horse jolts slightly, and there's a farting noise. You know, oh, that's what we do. It's like with Monty Python, it's Hell's Grannies. You know, you take two completely incompatible things and you put them together. So a philosopher's football match, you know.
Mm.
Once you get that, which happened to Python, the 4th series was really well made, but somehow it had stopped being funny because there's no surprise in it anymore. And I think that's slightly true of Not the 9 o'clock News. I don't think it's true of Blackadder, but I think when people say, oh, you should repeat that, I think it's such a terrible idea. You can't top the end of Blackadder 4. You just can't do that. You can get back from that and do another series. It would be insulting, I think.
Would you say that the last episode of Blackadder goes forth? Because what are your mantras, if you like, is disaster is a gift.
Yes, it is.
And would you say that the ending of Blackadder 4, as you originally shot it, out of the disaster came a gift?
Yes, I mean, it's a story I've told before. Forgive me, listeners, if you've heard it, but the way Blackadder worked was that everything was workshopped to death in the studio. Every line was gone over, every syllable was gone over by everybody. And of course, almost all the actors are also well-known writers, and they weren't about to do a sort of second-rate line if the person before them had just had a cracker. So a lot of time was spent, you know, trying to work out whether courgette was a funnier vegetable than cabbage and so forth. So we were always very late with the printed script, and poor Rowan had to stay up, you know, all night learning this blooming thing. And when it came to the last episode, absolutely brilliant writing by Ben Elton and Richard Curtis. I mean, terrific writing and brilliant performances to match that with an extraordinary sort of emotional curve in the episode, where it starts all larky and jolly and everyone's looking forward to, you know, going home after the war as just one big push, and gradually all the humor drains out of the episode and it becomes more and more serious and indeed very moving and sad, and you begin to feel sorry for people you'd rather despised.
Listen, our guns have stopped.
You don't think?
Maybe the war's over. Maybe it's peace.
Oh, hurrah! The big knobs have got round the table and yanked the iron out of the fire.
Thank God. We lived through it. The Great War, 1914 to 1917.
Hip, hip, hooray!
I'm afraid not. The guns have stopped because we're about to attack. Not even our generals are mad enough to shell their own men. They think it's far more sporting to let the Germans do it.
And then they're all lined up in the trench and the whistle blows, and the idea that they would then run over the top and, you know, it would all be incredibly dramatic and exciting. And we hadn't had time to rehearse the actors in the set of No Man's Land, which was so huge, we'd had to take a whole other studio for it. And the set was covered with, you know, real wooden ladders and real barbed wire and puddles and, you know, enormous expense to do this, and stuff called Fuller's Earth, which is a kind of fake soil.
Mm.
So it was as realistic as we could make it. and the actors were rushed into the studio with just 10 minutes to go before we ran out of recording time and action, and they went up the ladder. Somebody hurt their leg on the ladder. You can hear them cursing. Oh, God, this is... You could hear them saying, we haven't even rehearsed this. This is fucking ridiculous. And they go over the top, and then the fireworks started, and nobody'd warned them there were going to be pyrotechnics. And these massive bangs and a light going off, there's people cutting their legs, and they're trying to run on this earth, and they can't get traction. And you can hear them just really upset. And we are sitting in the main studio with, 600 people in the audience watching this complete disaster go in front of us. It went on forever. And everyone's looking at their feet going, oh, dear, how embarrassing. What are we going to do? And I got on the mic to the PA who was looking after the actors and said, we need to do another take. We've just got 5 minutes to do another take because we can't use that. And Rowan grabbed the walkie-talkie from the PA and said, John, that was absolutely disgraceful. It was a terrifying experience, the worst thing that's ever happened to me on a set, and we are absolutely not doing a second take. I'm sorry, but we're on strike. So we got to the edit, and we've got this beautifully made episode, brilliantly directed by Richard Bowden, wonderfully performed. Everything was right about it. And then this terrible, amdram, awful, embarrassing scene stuck on the end. But because by that time it's a very welded production team, everyone's in the room, how are we going to make this work? And piece by piece, each person in the room had one idea. Chris Wadsworth, the brilliant editor, said, John, I tell you what, maybe if we slow it down, I mean, not just a bit, but let's go counterintuitively. They're running too slowly. So let's go the other way. Let's make them really slow. So it takes them 2 seconds just to do a step. And you think, wow, that's interesting. And then the assistant editor says, like, why don't we slow the sound down too? So that all the explosions are like all in slow motion and Howard's music played on a single piano in a gymnasium gets this wonderful, plangent, spooky noise. And then they think, wait, hey, what if we, let's turn it to sepia, like it's an old photograph. And we're beginning to getting goose pimples just talking about it. And then Jenny, my PA, says, John, just give me a minute. I just got to go up to the photo library. I've had an idea. And she comes back with this wonderful still of poppies growing in a field in France, just millions of them. Yeah. And the two editors just do this amazing slow mix. They mix between the poppies, the bright red poppies, and the sepia of the four actors running across the field. And by some magic thing, it was no trickery, there was no CGI, no technical expertise. What appears to happen is the actors disappear into the earth like ghosts. They fade away, and out of the land comes these wonderful flowers. And we're all standing there, just humbled by this extraordinary thing that's happened. A catastrophe has turned into one of the great moments of television. I think it still remains there. And I'm sitting there, having had not contributed a single thing to the conversation, apart from going, yes, that works. And I said, we can't have credits on this. You can't have best boy and assistant lighting director over this. We're just going to have a caption right at the end saying Blackadder 1485 to 1917. So that's how it came about, and it was a really magical moment.
Good luck, everyone.
Well, I can remember very vividly watching it for the first time, and I would have been 15. When I saw it, and I cried, and I was embarrassed. I must admit, I was I couldn't help it because I had my family were there, but I cried. I was just so incredibly moved by it.
Well, it's so one of those things. Yeah, and it's something. Like, I mean, I'm not a conventionally religious person, but sometimes you have a sense that the universe is bizarrely on your side as a pat on the back. You tried really hard and we're going to give you a little treat here. And the two effects of it I remember, one is that Ben Elton's uncle was a famous historian called G.R. Elton. And when Ben announced we were going to do a sitcom set in the First World War in the trenches, Geoffrey Elton wrote to Ben saying, I can't believe a nephew of mine could think of something so appallingly tasteless. And after the last episode, he wrote again to Ben saying, okay, I see what you mean. That was amazing.
Mm.
And Rowan had so many letters from old ladies whose fiancés and husbands had been killed in the First World War saying, thank you for understanding.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, so it's always ridiculous when Michael Gove says things like Blackadder shouldn't be taught in schools because it's not patriotic. You say, oh, come on.
Yeah.
You just haven't watched it, have you? You haven't watched how much we care, how much we cared and how much respect we had for those people, you know? And of course, you know, soldiers are of all kinds. There are brave ones and cowardly ones and, you know, dutiful ones and slackers and...
Yeah. Well, I mean, Gove probably didn't like the fact that you were satirising Haig in the final episode. Haig was probably a hero.
Well, if Blackadder owes anything sort of serious historical research, is there's a book called Lions Led by Donkeys, which is was the standard view that the Tommies were great and the generals were no good. But of course, it's much more nuanced than that. My great uncle was one of the people who started what became the Tank Corps in the First World War. So they weren't all idiots at all. It was a thing, you know, nobody really understands what happened with the First World War. It's just a sort of inevitability to do with, you know, trade timetables and, you know, economic wresting of power and the end of empire and all that. There's nobody's one person's fault. But to kind of make the claim that it was all jolly good fun, the First World War, and, you know, and everybody should celebrate how great it was, is like, no, it was a horrible experience for all sides.
Absolutely.
And you shouldn't go on, you know, glorifying it. We should be sorry for everybody who lost their lives in such a terrible, terrible situation.
In Blackadder Goes Forth, didn't you come up with the German spy idea in the hospital?
I don't remember that. I never can remember, you know, so I'm a very collegiate producer, I hope. I mean, well, I listen to everyone in the room and the best idea wins for me. Of course, I historically got to decide which is the best idea, which would be my view. But everybody gets a say in anything that I produce, because I think if you've got, you know, 10 bright people in the room, why not? Why not have everybody's view? So I can't remember who thought of which line.
Okay.
And there are still people on the crew who are still arguing to this day who wrote which line where. I think we did it together. That's the thing. That's what I feel.
Sure, sure. Do you remember anything about Reg Aykroyd's Silly Scandals?
Yes, indeed. And Barry Cryer, bless him, one of the great human beings ever.
Absolutely.
Used to remind me of being in that. It was Barry and Jimmy Perry, one of the writers of Dad's Army, and Nick Rowley's music from my old Footlights days. It was silly, a very old-fashioned thing. And Barry always used to say that, do you remember that great promise that John Lloyd showed with Reg Aykroyd's Silly Scandals? Whatever happened to him? You know, we had a go. It didn't really work. It was a bit old-fashioned. Good bits, but, you know, I was going through a patch, Tyler, where I have no idea why, but I suddenly, as a very young radio producer, probably 25 or so, quite famous people, much more famous, obviously, than me, wanted to work with me because I'd had a couple of early successes.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted to work with me, but when I said, I don't think this is really working, they go, excuse me, we are actually rather famous comedians and you're 25 and I think we know best. So I wasn't as tough on Barry and Jimmy as I would have been with my peers, you know, with Mel Griff and You know, Richard Curtis, where I was a peer-to-peer, and I was going to be, if I didn't think it was good enough, I was certainly going to say so and insist that it be better, whereas I didn't really feel it was my part to say to Barry, that's a bit of an old, you know, a bit of an old joke or something. And I did a similar series called Offbeat with Braden, with Bernard Braden, who was a wonderful Canadian comedian, where the same thing, I deferred to his experience and celebrity when I wasn't really, my heart wasn't really in it. And that again only lasted one series. And after that, I swore I'd never do that again. I mean, the way I was trained was go and make stuff you like. And I said at 22, what do you mean what I like? And they said, well, at least you guaranteed an audience of one, aren't you? But if you try and guess what old people like or people of a different cultural background like or what young people like, you're bound to get it wrong. So your best judge, your best and least patronizing and actually most respectful way of treating the audience is to treat them like they're you. And Martin Scorsese, I always love this quote, he said, when I make a movie, I am the audience. So it's good enough for Scorsese, it's good enough for me.
Totally. Do you remember writing with Douglas Adams, the remarkable fidgety river.
Yeah.
which was one of two episodes of Dr. Snuggles that you wrote.
Yes, I remember that very well. Yes, we used to moonlight in the evenings. We were both radio producers and we had the next door office and we would moonlight trying to get sketches on. Well, I used to do a lot of stuff for the Two Ronnies. I actually got two one-liners on the Two Ronnies and this opportunity came up for this animated series made in Holland by, I remember we used to find this terribly funny. I didn't in those days speak any Dutch, which I now do, but the producer was called Joop Fish and his secretary was called Veronica Plink. And we thought that was terribly funny, but they were very nice and very good. And Peter Ustinov was the voiceover and it was great fun. They would, we actually paid rather well for it, I seem to remember. We really enjoyed doing it. Because great, you know, you can imagine Douglas's imagination in animation. You can do literally anything you want. You're not tied to what an actor can perform.
It was a very hot day. We were all trying very hard to cool down while we waited for Coot Boot to return from Uncle Bill's lobsterscape deep under the Pacific Ocean. It was so hot, I needed a glass of water. Oh, what on earth are you doing in there, Nobby?
Just trying to keep cool.
What do you remember of doing the Land of Confusion video for Genesis?
Well, this is, I was just telling someone this story the other day, actually. Because, so Genesis, or their management anyway, came to us and said, we want to do a pop video with music video with all the puppets. And we thought, wow, this is amazing. We really made it. MTV was king in those, so it was quite new, very exciting, and everybody watched it. And so it was 385 puppets, I think. And I was the person, I wrote the storyboard and drew it up painstakingly. The management put on the job a guy called Jim Jukic, who was their live video director. So he would shoot all their concerts, but obviously he wasn't a drama director and certainly never worked with puppets. Nice guy. So Jim sat in the back and I knew how to direct puppets and puppeteers and it was my script. So I shot it, edited it. Jim went back to LA. And it won everything, you know, it won a Grammy and heaven knows what. But I never got asked to any of the award ceremonies. So years later in the 90s, I think, I was watching I was on an ad shoot in LA. And after the shoot, I went to my hotel room. I thought I'd have room service, have a drink. And a program came on the telly called MTV's 100 Greatest Music Videos of All Time. And I thought, well, Land of Confusion must win something.
Yeah.
And so I started watching at the beginning of the show, and it went up through the hundreds and the 90s and the 80s, and I started to get depressed. I thought, we must have got something. It must be somewhere in there in the 50s and the 40s and the 30s. By that time, I'm halfway through the minibar and beginning to find it quite difficult to focus. And it gets up to the top 10. And now I'm really, you know, this is really, I've put so much work into that. It must get something.
You're on the window ledge by this point.
Pretty much. Mm. And then it gets to, and ladies and gentlemen, and number one in MTV's greatest music videos of all time, Genesis, Land of Confusion. And Jim Jukic gets up in Century City, or wherever it is, in his dicky bow, and goes and accepts the award. And he didn't even tell me he was up for it.
Oh.
I've never spoken to him since, and I probably won't. But it was like, that seemed to me a bit rude, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I read that Mike Rutherford's puppet was later repurposed to be Jesus Christ in a spitting image sketch.
Oh, might well have been, yeah. I saw Mike the other day, actually, because I've spoken to Mike since then.
Hmm.
And I remember talking to... calling up Phil Collins and saying, what's this line mean in the song, Phil? And he goes, it doesn't mean anything. It's a song. What are you talking about? Oh, okay, fine. I can do what I want then. But it was a real highlight. We loved doing it, and it was quite innovative in its day. We used Oxford Scientific films to do some of the shots, which is very radical, interesting tracking shots with unusual cameras, normally used for wildlife shots, you know.
Can you tell me about the Golden Brain Hunt?
Yeah, so it was a competition to find Reagan's brain, which was a golden walnut that we were going to bury off a place called Thatcher Rock off the coast of Devon.
Mm.
And due to the normal shambles of my hopeless administration, it was going to be radioactive, so you could only find it with a Geiger counter. I wrote the quiz, the very complicated quiz all written in Morse code and the NATO alphabet and things, all sorts of clever tricks. It was a doable puzzle, but very difficult. And somebody realized that by the time we published the book, they couldn't get to Thatcher Rock because it was illegal to bury things on it or something. So we never actually buried the brain, but somebody did solve it. They worked it out from first principles, and they got the prize too. I think it was £1,000.
Wasn't there meant to be a celebrity who knew the answer or knew the location, and people had to work out who the celebrity was?
I can't remember. About 5 years ago, somebody sent me the article of the person who'd worked it out. And I must admit, I was quite taken aback with how difficult it was, the puzzle. But it all stacked up. Apart from that, we didn't physically bury it. But when they worked out where it would have been buried, we gave them the prize.
Brilliant. Okay, well, listen, John, time is against us, and I really do appreciate giving up part of your evening to talk to me. We haven't even had a chance to talk about QI or Hitchhikers or a news quiz, Museum of Curiosity as well. I mean, that's still going strong, isn't it?
Well, I don't know. They haven't mentioned the new series, so we've yet to. I bumped into the producer actually at a Christmas party just now, and I said, "Have you heard anything?" He said, "No, they haven't said anything to me."
Oh, right.
So you just never know. But, I mean, at least you can see, Tyler, that it's not been a smooth road a lot of the time, and nor is it likely to be. If you're going to do things well, it's going to be difficult. That is definitely another of my mantras. You know, if it's easy, it's probably not very good. Probably not. I mean, I'm not saying that's universal, but that's a general rule of thumb. To do something well takes a lot of hard work and a lot of mistakes, and it is generally quite difficult. I think most artists would say, you know, that's, again, it's not true, for example, of songs, I don't think. I think a lot of songs have been written in 10 minutes that are very famous. But of course, it's rather like the Chinese artist who goes to the emperor, and the emperor says, "I hear you're a brilliant painter of fish. Draw me a fish." And the guy does three strokes of a brush, and there's an amazing fish. And the emperor says, "Well, I'm not going to pay you for that. It only took you 4 seconds." And the painter says, "No, that took me 60 years
Yes.
to be able to do that."
What a very deep note to end on.
Well, thank you for your research, Tyler. Very thorough. I'm sorry I haven't got longer to.
No, listen, it's been brilliant.
To jaw with you. You can do a part two maybe sometime. But I don't have any more goon stories. That's the only problem.
That's fine. That's fine. Listeners know this. I love to talk about comedy in general, comedy that I love. And you've been responsible for so much of it. So tip of the hat to you, John, and have a brilliant Christmas.
Thanks, Tyler. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Morning, dear.
Hey, Nance. What a terrible dream. I am parched. That's better. I could use another one of those. That's one heck of a nurse.